Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Hell on earth, and then some. Extreme weather, no longer a question of when, but where. I'm Shepard Smith. This is the news on CNBC.
Extreme weather sweeping the globe, America, Europe, and now Asia. Rushing waters trap and kill people on the subway. City streets transformed into raging rivers. Tonight, the worldwide impact. Shots ring out in Milwaukee. Across the country, many fearful of a rise in crime. The man hoping to be New York City's next mayor joins us, Eric Adams, on his plan to stop the violence. Mandates and restrictions, cities debating new rules as the pandemic surges. We visit a hospital about to reopen its COVID ICU. The alarming difference this time around.
We asked to do our job. We want to do our job.
A giant step backward. The Republican minority leader threatens to pull all his selections to investigate the Capitol insurrection after Speaker Pelosi rejects two GOP members. Harvey Weinstein back in court. American Olympians sidelined with COVID. And acid-shooting lobsters.
Live from CNBC, the facts, the truth, the news with Shepard Smith.
And good evening. Across three continents, cities are either on fire or underwater. If the summer feels apocalyptic, for many it is. In China, at least 25 people are dead after the heaviest rainfall in 1,000 years. In the U.S., more than 70 wildfires burning in the West, fueled by record heat and drought. Streets in Germany swallowed by torrential floods, forest fires, and a heat wave ravaging some of Russia's frozen tundra. Climate experts say this is a crisis that demands attention right now. But COVID has made that difficult. It's an excuse that climate envoy John Kerry says can no longer stand.
I am very sorry to say the suffering of COVID will be magnified many times over in a world that does not grapple with and ultimately halt the climate crisis. We don't have the luxury of waiting until COVID is vanquished to take up the climate challenge.
We'll speak to renowned climate expert Andrew Dessler about the extreme weather. But first to central China, the latest region to suffer mightily. Record floods displaced 1.2 million people there, a normal year's worth of rain in just 3 days. Officials say at least 500 people were trapped inside subway cars during the flooding. Terrifying videos from inside. Look at this, showing people neck deep in water. Local media in China reporting rescuers had to cut open the roofs just to pull people to safety. Officials say at least a dozen people died in the subway. CNBC's Eunice Yoon begins our coverage from Beijing.
This is the result of the heaviest rains to hit central China in 1,000 years. Avenues in Zhengzhou barely recognizable, but traffic the city's 12 million have never seen. Social media videos capture the rush hour that broke records. 4 months of rainfall from 4 to 5 p.m. Tuesday, when residents braved floodwaters in human chains, by car, and then by subway after bus services stopped. But within the hour on this subway line, calls for help. Mayday, mayday, a man cries. Flood barriers at subway entrances are breached. 10 minutes later, all carriages halted. The water is up to our waists, a passenger narrates. In another subway car, tempers flare as fears about oxygen levels rise, along with the floodwaters. Stop talking, he shouts. Outside, rescuers show up, among tens of thousands sent here by President Xi, who called for authorities at all levels to pitch in. Into the night, they rescue trapped school children, restore power, and move residents to safety. Throughout the province of Hunan, troops focus on preventing dam breaches and potential mishaps like this explosion at an aluminum factory near Zhengzhou. Authorities fear wheat crops and metal production could later be affected. For now, though, back on the subway, a woman breathes a sigh of relief. Firefighters have arrived, she says. We're saved.
Local authorities estimate crop damage at $83 million so far, with economic losses only expected to grow as heavy rains continue to pound the area for another day. Shep?
Eunice, thanks. Four corners of the earth, there are disasters. So let's turn to Andrew Dessler, climate scientist at Texas A&M. Andrew, how much is climate change exacerbating the intensity of these floods and the heat and the fires?
Yeah, I mean, climate change is now a factor in every single weather event that occurs, and it's making heat waves worse. It's making intense rainfall worse. It's causing sea level to go up. It's acidifying the ocean. It affects everything that we experience now.
You know, you've said recently that these disasters have you wondering if the climate models on which we've all been relying are wrong. What did you mean by that?
You know, I think if you described to me what's going on now a few months ago, I would have said you're crazy.
Just a few months ago.
It sounds like a dystopian sci-fi novel. You kind of look around, you look at like the Pacific Northwest heat wave. That is far greater than anything the models predicted. Now, maybe that's just a very unlucky event and more research will be done on that. But, you know, I think the models do an excellent job on the global climate. But as far as predicting these extreme events, you know, it's looking like things are actually going to be worse than our worst case analysis. So I just have to say, you know, for decades, people called climate scientists alarmists. Yeah. You know, I think in the future, that's going to end up being a really sad commentary on inaction in the face of really strong science.
Well, to that point, if the models are indeed not capturing how bad all this could get, are our cities prepared?
Yeah, you know, I think the regardless of the extent to which climate change is affecting these events, the most important lesson that everybody should take from this is that this is just a small preview of what's coming. And our infrastructure is clearly not capable of handling this. You look at the heat wave of the Pacific Northwest, you look at the floods in China and Europe. And I mean, if we don't stop climate change from warming, if we don't take action to head this up, it's going to be an incredibly expensive, painful experience as we have to rebuild trillions of dollars of infrastructure to handle a world with bigger heat waves, higher sea level, more intense rain events. It's going to be very painful and very expensive.
Andrew Dessler with a look ahead. Thank you. COVID Watch now. More local leaders are starting to bring back mask rules. One of the latest is in Pasadena. The city in California will soon require everyone to wear a face mask indoors, vaccinated or not. Officials there also working on a policy that would require city employees in Pasadena to get a COVID shot. New York City just announced it'll now mandate vaccinations or weekly COVID tests for all public health care workers. But Mayor Bill de Blasio said he has no plans of asking people to mask up indoors, at least not right now.
If you're talking about fighting COVID and the Delta variant and winning this battle once and for all, a mask is like a pea shooter and the vaccine is like a cannon. The vaccine is what actually wins.
And to encourage people to get the vaccine, the Republican governor of Missouri announced a vaccine incentive program today. Get this. He says the state will give 900 vaccinated people there $10,000 each.
We encourage all Missourians to consider getting vaccinated, as almost all new COVID hospitalizations can be attributed to unvaccinated individuals.
And in South Carolina, the COVID ICU at Lexington Medical Center closed about 4 months ago. They didn't need it anymore. Now they do. And state health officials say they're considering reopening it. The number of COVID patients there, by way of example, increased from 0 to 8 in 1 week. One doctor says it's almost like he's waking up from some kind of dream. There still aren't nearly as many patients as there were last summer, but the numbers are rising and fast. And the main difference between then and now is the age of the COVID patients. Health officials now say they're treating much younger people. In West Columbia, here's NBC's Ellison Barber.
catch-up while we were on that ICU floor. A ninth COVID patient arrived needing intensive care. Of the nine that were in the ICU when we were there, all but one of them were unvaccinated. In the first room, there was a 26-year-old. Directly across from him, there was someone in their 40s. In the room next door to that person, there was a patient in their 30s, all of them on ventilators. We met one man who spent nearly 2 months in this hospital. He was in the ICU on a ventilator, at one point did not think he would survive. He was eligible to get vaccinated months before he got sick, but he didn't do it. He thought the vaccines were too new. It's a decision he says he regrets every day. He's hoping if people won't listen to their doctors, they'll listen to him.
I would tell them, like, yeah, go ahead and get the vaccination, because the COVID is for real. Like, it had me on my dying bed, and I didn't know whether I was going to make it back or not.
We also spoke to one patient who was a breakthrough case. She was fully vaccinated but got COVID-19 and ended up in the hospital. She has multiple sclerosis, MS. She told us that she thinks had she not been vaccinated, she would be a lot sicker, maybe in the ICU. Statewide, hospitalizations have increased by 103% because of COVID-19 in less than a month.
Allison Barber from South Carolina. Big picture now, the United States will keep its borders with Canada and Mexico closed to all non-essential travel, at least for another month. That's the word today from the Department of Homeland Security. In a tweet, the agency wrote the moves aimed at slowing the spread of COVID, including especially the Delta variant. The announcement comes just days after Canadian officials reported they would soon let fully vaccinated Americans into Canada. Crime in America. Tonight, the man who hopes to be the next mayor of America's largest city, Eric Adams, plans to tackle crime in a place where he says lawlessness has become the norm. Coordinated attacks on retail stores. Groups of thieves clearing off shelves, making a clean getaway. Now businesses finding creative ways to fight back. And a settlement, an enormous one, with companies accused of fueling the opioid epidemic. The landmark $26 billion payout, and importantly, where that money is going.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Shootings. Two simultaneous shootings in downtown Milwaukee sent basketball fans running for cover late last night as they celebrated the Bucks NBA championship win. Cops say three people were hurt. They arrested two folks, and they're still searching for the other suspects. The shootings as the United States is on track to have the deadliest year of gun violence in decades. In New York City, shootings are up about 22% from the same time last year and up more than 100% from the same time in 2019. That's according to NYPD data. But it's not just shootings. Murders also up by 3% from the same time last year and more than 38% from the year before. Last week, during a news conference on gun violence, the Democratic nominee for mayor of New York warned of rising crime in NYC and said, quote, "We have surrendered our city." Eric Adams now, The Brooklyn Borough President, former police captain himself. Sir, thanks so much for being with us. Crime is obviously up across the country. It's up across the city. You've called New York City a place where lawlessness is the norm. Should you become our mayor, what do you plan to do about it on day one?
Well, we want to really look at, in particularly certain communities, where we have normalized the lawlessness that you're seeing and on so many different levels. And it's just about being good neighbors again. How do we ensure that we deal with some of the quality of life issues that we're facing? Everything from the gun violence that you're seeing really being generated by gangs in our city. We're going to use precision policing, zero in on those gang members, and really partner with our local district attorneys so that we can stop seeing this revolving door criminal justice system where people commit crimes with guns and they're out the next day. That is just unacceptable, and it really hurts the quality of life in our city.
You know, our city has problems like cities all over the country. One with which I know you're familiar is Washington Square Park. I happen to live in that neighborhood. During the pandemic, a lot of homeless people started sleeping there. Some gangs ended up there. Now there's a series of parties that just sort of spring up there with people from all over the city. It's fairly well out of control, as the city's admitted. But if you come in with the long arm and show these scenes of clearing people out, that's no good. So what do you do? Where's the nuance?
And great question. And you're right. And sometimes when people talk about just using the Washington Square Park issue, and it's just for the affluent New Yorkers that live around the park. That is just not true. I walked through the park the other day, and I'm often there. And my son and I, as we walked through, someone was injecting themselves with heroin right there in the park. That is not what our parks should be made of. So first thing we should do, we should temporarily close down the park to do a massive cleaning. Then before closing the park down for a period of time, 2 weeks to clean the park and get it back in order, prior to doing that, we should go there on the ground, interact with people and give them the services they need. Those who are homeless, let's find housing for them with wraparound services. Those who have drug users, let's get those who deal with mental health illnesses and other issues that people are facing and give them the support. So let's spend some time really giving the services in the park, close it down, clean it, and then reopen the park with a clear set of guidelines and rules.
You've met with the president on gun violence, 376 shootings, mass shootings across the country this year alone. The gun violence problem, is there a way to solve it in this country under the current political climate?
Yes, we have in America some of the finest law enforcement entities on the federal, the state, and city levels. What I shared with the president, that we need to do the same thing we did when we saw the World Trade Center attacked with terrorism. We need to do the same with guns and gangs, share information, and zero in on it. And we have to be honest, we've ignored the handgun crisis that is predominantly in Black, brown, and poor communities. We went after the assault weapons, but we did not deal with the handguns. That was a big mistake. Let's stop the flow. Let's go after illegal dealers, and let's zero in on those gangs across our country, specifically here in New York City.
Eric Adams on Crime in America, thank you. Governor Gavin Newsom out in California cracking down on crime at retail stores. The governor signed a bill today. It would allow special task forces to focus on the problem. The move comes after several viral videos that you probably saw showing people smashing store windows and shoplifting right in the middle of the day. With how business owners are now responding, here's NBC's Jacob Ward.
In California, a pack of thieves flees with armfuls of stolen merchandise, security tags still attached. In Washington, a coordinated attack on store shelves. In New York, another group strikes.
Turn around on your face!
But this isn't just shoplifting.
This isn't candy bars. This is hundreds of dollars in merchandise.
What we're really seeing is the growth of organized retail crime. They prey on vulnerable folks. So they'll go to a juvenile. They'll go to a homeless person. They'll say, here's $100. Here's a list of things we need you to go in and steal.
Criminals often resell stolen goods online or even return them for gift cards. In San Francisco, we filmed this open market where police have said stolen items are offered up each morning. A report from the National Retail Federation found that more than $700,000 per billion in sales is lost to this sort of theft. Less than a tenth of a percent doesn't sound like much, but in an industry where some items are sold at cost just to bring customers in, it's a big number.
If you're a major national retailer facing a shoplifting epidemic, what do you do? Well, here in San Francisco, six Target stores are going to try to reduce their exposure by limiting their operating hours.
Walgreens blames this sort of theft for closing 17 locations in the last 5 years. Retailers have reported a roughly 60% increase in dollars lost since 2015. They point to several factors: reduced staffing during the pandemic and low morale, new hands-off store policies, and lower penalties. California, for instance, raised the threshold for a felony charge from $450 to $950 in stolen goods.
And some people calculate, hey, you know, I don't want to go over the $950, so let me steal $949 worth of property.
San Francisco's police chief says that means the stores have to be willing to detain someone.
If it's a felony, our officers can take action, but if it's a misdemeanor, that arrest has to be a private person's arrest.
Retailers now keep even low-cost items under lock and key. Customers are forced to buzz associates for everyday items, from toothpaste to hair products to that six-pack of beer.
Is organized retail theft a big enough deal that it's going to sort of change these stores, do you think?
A lot of retailers are seriously considering closing or curtailing hours in a lot of different markets, in large part because of the theft. And something that may seem innocuous and harmless is not. It's scary and it's detrimental, extremely expensive. And again, all they got to do, I don't like this, pull out my phone, I'm going to order somewhere else.
Shep, industry experts tell me that retailers have in fact been experimenting with facial recognition systems and have used the technology to identify roving groups of thieves who go from store to store. In fact, one experimental system gives you and I a choice as customers. We can either press a button to buzz over an associate to open the case or scan our own features into facial recognition. Now, it's important to note that retailers are not currently deploying that technology, and that is because these experts say they are worried that surveilling their customers may actually drive them away, and that that might cost retailers more than shoplifting has. Shep?
Jacob Ward, thank you. Our Crime in America series continues tomorrow night, including local reporting out of Philadelphia. With more than 300 homicides in Philly so far this year, we'll hear from grief counselors who say their demand is up sixfold. And a person who's in 1992 negotiated the truce between the Bloods and the Crips, how to work to de-escalate situations before they turn violent tomorrow night. The committee to investigate the attack on the Capitol falling apart. Two of the Republican picks rejected. Both parties trading blows as we hear from the only Republican who's actually on board. And some of the richest men in all the world have reached space, but thanks to a new, brand new proposal, return trips may cost quite a bit more.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
In Washington, the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi today rejected two Trump allies from serving on the January 6th Select Committee to investigate the Capitol insurrection. And now the House Minority Leader, Kevin McCarthy, is threatening to pull all of his appointees and boycott the whole process. Speaker Pelosi vetoed GOP Representatives Jim Jordan of Ohio and Jim Banks of Indiana. On January 6th, both congressmen voted to overturn the election results, even after Trump supporters stormed the Capitol. Today, Leader McCarthy called Speaker Pelosi's veto an egregious abuse of power.
This panel has lost all legitimacy and credibility. And it shows exactly what I warned back at the beginning of January, that Pelosi would play politics with this.
Congresswoman Liz Cheney, Speaker Pelosi's Republican appointee to the committee, blasted Leader McCarthy's comments and defended the speaker's decision to block his appointees.
The rhetoric that we have heard from the minority leader is disingenuous. At every opportunity, the minority leader has attempted to prevent the American people from understanding what happened, to block this investigation. The idea that anybody would be playing politics with an attack on the United States Capitol is despicable and is disgraceful.
Of course, House Republicans stripped Congresswoman Cheney of her leadership position a couple of months ago after she called out the former president's big lie over the election. NBC's Sahil Kapoor now. Sahil, they're fighting, so now what?
Shep, the reality of this situation is that this January 6th committee is going to begin its work and have its first hearing regardless of how all of this shakes out. Now, Speaker Pelosi had vetoed two of House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy's picks for this committee, and McCarthy has threatened to withdraw all five of them. Unless one of them backs down here in this standoff, the committee is going to have to move forward with only the eight of Speaker Pelosi's choices, which includes seven Democrats and one Republican in Liz Cheney. At the end of the day, the strange reality of the situation, Shep, is that both parties are getting essentially a bit of what they want here. Democrats wanted to do a serious investigation of the January 6th attack, focused on that event without Trump allies there to run interference on his behalf. Republicans had never been that enthusiastic about investigating that attack for the politically awkward fact that it was supporters of Donald Trump who ransacked this Capitol. They can now move on, as Kevin McCarthy suggested, to investigating other things, other forms of violence such as Antifa and those associated with the political left, which they were more enthusiastic about doing. Bottom line, Speaker Pelosi's eight members have a quorum to continue this panel and to begin its work next week when it will hear from police officers in D.C. Metro Police and the Capitol Police who are defending against this attack. Shep?
Sahil Kapoor, thank you. A state of emergency, a dangerous virus, a ban on spectators. Not ideal conditions for any event, much less the opening ceremony. How Olympic organizers plan to pull it off. Plus, another day, another Team USA athlete tests positive for COVID. We're live in Tokyo with the latest as we approach the bottom of the hour and the top of the news on CNBC. The biggest names in business talking crypto, and that's what's topping CNBC on the money. Tesla's Elon Musk's and the Square CEO Jack Dorsey and ARK's Kathy Woods discussing cryptocurrency at the B Word conference. Some highlights include Dorsey saying he thinks Bitcoin will be the currency of the internet at some point. Kathy Woods predicting apps will be built on top of blockchains like Bitcoin. And Elon Musk addressing accusations that he's manipulating prices.
Now, I might pump, but I don't dump. And I would like to see Bitcoin succeed.
Well, a House Democrat taking aim at the billionaire space race with taxes. Oregon's Earl Blumenauer proposing now the Securing Protections Against Carbon Emissions, or Space Tax Act. It targets space flights for purposes other than scientific research and aims to charge a 10% per passenger tax, similar to those on airline tickets. And baby showers reimagined for the business world. Get this, entrepreneurs are now throwing business showers for their new ventures. The goal? Build community support for their new endeavor, whatever it may be. One company even offering a virtual kit called Startup Stork to help you plan the bash. Congratulations, you're having an LLC. On Wall Street, the Dow up again, 286. S&P up 36. The NASDAQ up 133. I'm Shepard Smith on CNBC. It's the bottom of the hour. Time for the top of the news. The new bill inspired by Britney Spears. Lawmakers from both parties taking on conservatorships. But can they actually pass legislation that could help? Inside a booming market for trading cards. See the tiny pieces of paper worth millions and the collectors willing to spend big. And let the games begin. Even as another U.S. athlete tests positive for COVID. Team USA men's beach volleyball player Taylor Crabb could miss the summer games after he tested positive for COVID. NBC News reports the 29-year-old got the diagnosis shortly after he landed in Japan. We don't know whether he was vaccinated. But Crabb joins three other U.S. athletes who've tested positive. The tennis star Coco Gauff, the gymnast Kara Aker, and women's 3-on-3 basketball player Katie Lou Samuelson. The news comes as COVID cases continue to rise in Tokyo. NBC News' Tom Yamas is there for us this morning. Tom, COVID continues to be a problem at the Olympics.
It does, Shep. Great to be with you tonight. More than 80 people involved with the Olympics here in Japan have tested positive for COVID here in Tokyo or somewhere in the country. And, Shep, I don't know if you shoot skeet, but if you do, there is no chance you could beat Britain's Amber Hill. She's ranked number one in the world. And the big news that just happened, she tested positive for COVID back in her home country. So she's not going to be able to make it to Tokyo. So this, no doubt, is still looming large over the Tokyo Games. This, as Tokyo itself is dealing with a 150% increase in new infections week to week. One of the head COVID experts here that sits on a panel that advises the Tokyo government said at this rate, they'll have about 2,600 new infections in 2 weeks. So people in Tokyo are very concerned about COVID. Part of the problem, only 23% of them are fully vaccinated. So a lot of the frustrations that people in Japan have for the government about not rolling out the vaccine fast enough has been projected on the Olympics. So I've been around Tokyo. I'm out of quarantine. I ask people, are you excited about the Olympics? And they tell you straight to your face, no, we're not excited. We're actually very concerned. We're going to watch on television, but we're not happy that the Olympics are here. But the train has left the station, Shep. Competition has started here in Tokyo. And of course, the big news, Team USA softball starting strong, entering the win column, beating Italy 2-0. I spoke with Kat Osterman. She was the pitcher. She pitched a shutout. She said it was weird to take the mound and look out and not see her family in the stands, but they are so happy to be here because softball hasn't been in the Olympics since 2008. So they were just proud to represent Team USA, and they had the disappointment last year when the games were postponed. Now, Team USA soccer, women's soccer, a different story. They had a really rough outing. They lost to Sweden. Their arch rival, who you may remember, knocked them out of the quarterfinals in Rio. They lost 3-0. The team has already spoken. They're going to have a news conference later today. They said they know they have to do better. They just weren't ready. Some commentators said they looked a little sluggish on the field there. They are the World Cup champions, the defending champs. I'm sure they're going to be able to come back.
A new streak begins now. Tom Yamas live in Tokyo. Thank you. And for the first time, Team USA will have two flag bearers at the opening ceremony. One of them will be the women's basketball star, Sue Bird. This morning on the Today Show, she spoke about what it means to carry the flag.
I've been asked what my favorite Olympic memory is. Of course, winning gold medals is number one, but, you know, outside of that, and it's my answer, like true to form, I swear, is when Dawn Staley, who's now my coach, who was a teammate in 2004, got selected to be the flag bearer. And it was the coolest thing because in my first Olympics, we got to be at the front of the line.
And Sue Bird set to share the honor with men's baseball infielder Eddie Alvarez. He won a silver medal back in the 2014 Winter Games in Sochi and a speed skater. The announcement comes as First Lady Dr. Jill Biden landed in Alaska before heading to Tokyo. Here she is. She's scheduled to lead the U.S. delegation. So far, Olympic organizers have not revealed very many details about the opening ceremony, but one thing's crystal clear. The pandemic will be front and center. On Friday, the world will finally come together for 2020's Olympic opening ceremony, even though the venue will be largely empty. After a billion-dollar makeover to increase capacity, Tokyo's historic Olympic Stadium will host fewer than 10,000 people. Most of them dignitaries, sponsors, and VIPs. In keeping with tradition, the White House says the First Lady, Jill Biden, will attend, just as she did in 2010 at the Vancouver Games. But this time, she's going solo.
You really have to be mentally prepared to go.
So are many athletes, their friends, families, and fans not allowed to cheer them on in person.
That one will actually make me cry.
It's awful that we're not going to have fans. We're not going to have that experience.
Team USA will once again wear Ralph Lauren, only this time they get a new accessory. During the ceremony, organizers say they will pay tribute to those who died in the pandemic. But most other details are still top secret. We do know this year's theme, United by Emotion. And officials promise the 2020 Games will be more inclusive than ever before.
We are United by Emotion.
Instead of one flag bearer, most countries will have two, a man and a woman.
Japan is very cognizant of the inequities that have been accentuated in our pandemic world in Japan as elsewhere. and they're very intent upon trying to deal with these inequalities.
Whether Rio, London, Beijing, or Athens, host cities fill the ceremonies with celebrations of their culture. Tokyo should be no different. That could include Japanese icons like Super Mario and Hello Kitty. Both made cameos in 2016 as Rio handed the baton to Tokyo.
Since 1964, Japan and its sort of global soft power has come to be defined less by kimono, less by these traditional arts and crafts, more by animation and J-pop. And you're going to definitely see more of that.
For hundreds of years, the Olympics have endured through challenging times, and organizers say they're hopeful they will again.
And the Summer Olympics in Tokyo, just about a day away. You can watch the games across all of our NBC properties, including ones I'll be hosting in prime time starting Monday night right here, CNBC. Havana Syndrome, figuring out who and what is behind it. Now, the CIA will get the help of the person who tracked down Osama bin Laden. And no opioid sales for 10 years. Just part of the giant deal reached today between Johnson & Johnson and multiple states. The disgraced movie mogul Harvey Weinstein pleading not guilty in a Los Angeles courtroom today to 4 counts of rape and 7 counts of sexual assault. Weinstein appeared in a wheelchair, his hands shackled to the armrest. He's already serving 23 years in prison after a jury convicted Weinstein of rape and sexual assault in New York. His lawyers tried to stop the extradition to California, but they lost a lengthy court battle, and Weinstein arrived yesterday in L.A. on this private jet. Drug companies settling for a landmark $26 billion to resolve nearly 4,000 opioid crisis lawsuits. That deal, with the country's 3 largest drug makers, or distributors, I should say, McKesson, Cardinal Health, and AmerisourceBergen, it's expected to pay a combined $21 billion. And then the drug maker, Johnson & Johnson, $5 billion. State and local governments accuse the companies of fueling the opioid epidemic, which has killed 500,000 Americans over the past 2 decades. Deaths from opioid overdoses reached a record high last year. Here's CNBC's Meg Terrell.
A group of state attorneys general calling the deal the second largest cash settlement in American history, behind the landmark 1998 settlement with tobacco companies for more than $200 billion.
These companies continue to profit off the misery, the death, and destruction nationwide. And today we put an end to it.
The deal doesn't cover Purdue Pharma and its billionaire owners, the Sackler family, negotiating a separate settlement as Purdue goes through bankruptcy, or a number of other companies also facing opioid litigation. And it's not a completely done deal yet. While at least 14 states express support for the settlement, all states have 30 days to sign on, and then another few months to convince counties and cities within their states to join as well. The more that join, the larger the payout overall. If a certain threshold isn't met, the deal may fall apart. None of the companies in the settlement admitted wrongdoing. North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein said they expected more than 40 states would ultimately sign on. And unlike in the tobacco settlement, which saw the money being put to other uses in states, this deal is designed to address the opioid crisis.
The $26 billion agreement will bring desperately needed resources home to each of our states, an estimated $750 million here in North Carolina, to help people struggling with opioid use disorder find hope, freedom from addiction, and happiness.
Not all states are on board, though. Washington's attorney general this afternoon rejecting the deal, saying it's not enough money for the state, and they think they can do better in court. Their trial against the 3 distributors is set to begin in September. Shep?
Meg, thanks. As expected, Senate Republicans have blocked a vote to start debate on a massive infrastructure package. GOP leaders demanding more time for a bipartisan group of senators to finish writing up an infrastructure bill. But the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says the Senate's already waited long enough and that it's time to get this ball rolling. CNBC Senior Congressional Correspondent Ilan Moy now. What happens next, Ilan?
Well, Shep, they keep talking. Even though that vote did fail along party lines, every Republican opposed it, Democrats voted for it, the vibe on the Hill was still pretty positive. You could even see Democrat Mark Warner and Republican Susan Collins chatting and laughing on the Senate floor while the vote was taking place. They're two of the senators who have been deeply involved in negotiating this agreement. And just moments after the vote failed, the bipartisan group released a statement saying they've made, quote, significant progress in their discussions and that they're optimistic they can advance this historic bipartisan proposal to strengthen America's infrastructure and create good-paying jobs in the coming days. Republicans said that could be as soon as Monday, but they just weren't ready today.
There's no outcome yet. No bipartisan agreement. No text. Nothing for the Congressional Budget Office to evaluate, and certainly nothing on which to vote. Not yet.
And even though he pushed ahead with the vote, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer tried to lower the stakes.
I have been very clear about what this vote is. This vote is only the first step in the legislative process on the Senate floor. This vote is not a deadline to have every final detail worked out. It is not an attempt to jam anyone.
Now, this all went down while President Biden was on his way to Ohio to drum up support for infrastructure. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki did downplay this procedural delay as just part of the legislative process. And when President Biden was asked if he thinks he'll be able to get a deal, the president was confident and responded, yes, we will.
Ilan, thank you. There is one issue that is gaining bipartisan support on Capitol Hill, and that's conservatorships, catapulted into the spotlight by the Free Britney movement. Democratic Congressman Charlie Crist and Republican Congresswoman Nancy Mace unveiled a new bill called the Free Act. They say it would give more protections to people under conservatorships. Lawmakers from both sides of the aisle have weighed in on Britney Spears' guardianship, including the Republican Senator Ted Cruz, who said he is unequivocally in the camp of Free Britney. And Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren, who called on the federal government to provide more data on conservatorships. This all comes after last month, Britney Spears testified in court that her situation was abusive and that she wanted her dad's control over her life to end. David Henderson now, civil rights attorney, former prosecutor, CNBC contributor. David, legally, what sort of impact could this Free Act have on Britney's case specifically?
Well, Shep, it's not going to have much of an impact on Britney's case. And honestly, Britney doesn't need it. The whole reason why she was able to get this ball rolling is the reason why. But the name here says it all. Freedom and right to emancipate from exploitation is what FREE stands for. What it's going to do is gather more information about who's in a conservatorship, because we don't actually know much about it. People will have the right to have a public guardian appointed instead of a private guardian with a vested interest in their case. And they're also going to have the right to have an independent caseworker evaluate what's going on.
So not for Britney, but for others and for the future, this could have a real impact.
It really could, Shep. And, you know, it's hard to think about why everyone would rally towards supporting Britney if you assume this is just a case about a pop star. But it's grown into be much more than that. And it's almost like a choose your own adventure novel, why you want to support the Free Britney movement, which gave rise to this.
You know, maybe it's because, go ahead.
No.
I was just going to say maybe it's because so many of us were in on it. Whether over the decades we read all of the clips, read all about her life and laughed and talked about it, or like I used to host a newscast on another network, and night after night we had a segment, America's Brit Tonight, and we would lay it all out. And in hindsight, it's embarrassing, and I wish it had never happened. We all understand better now. And, you know, you worry about people who are in this sort of a situation. How do you get out of it? I don't understand it.
Shep, that's a good point. And I think that's part of the reason why we have this act, because if you look at Britney's case, the only reason I think we know about this at all is because it happened during the pandemic. If this hadn't been during the pandemic, the lawyers and the judge would have cleared the court. We wouldn't have heard anything about it. And so I agree with everything you just said. And also, most of us fear that one of our parents will be elderly one day and we worry about how their needs will be provided for. This hits at the heart of that issue.
It really does, at the vulnerable here and everywhere. David, always good to talk to you. Thank you.
Likewise.
A CIA task force is now investigating the Havana Syndrome. And the leader of that task force is a veteran officer instrumental in hunting down and finding Osama bin Laden. NBC News confirmed that news today. This person who's still undercover is a 10-year veteran of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. As many as 200 Americans have reported cases of this Havana syndrome in every continent except Antarctica. Symptoms include brain injuries, vertigo, nausea, headaches, and many have reported hearing a strange, loud, piercing or grinding noise. A tiny piece of cardboard worth $1.5 million. The trading card market is hotter than ever. Up next, a world-famous DJ shows us his rare collection, and you'll meet a family of five spending thousands of dollars a month on their hobby. And some fresh content for your worst nightmares. The Vinegaroon. Part scorpion, part spider, all evil. Currently taking a break from the eighth circle of hell to visit our parks and spray acid from their tails. Thanks so much. The market for trading cards is booming right now. eBay reports people have already spent more than $1 billion just this year. Company officials say about 139 cards are sold every single minute. And when you do the math, that's more than 8,000 an hour and a whopping 200,000 cards a day. Trading hands, online marketplace. Collectors with both big and small budgets, treating them as investments. With some of the people behind the trading card boom, here's CNBC's Andrea Day.
Trading cards, from Pokemon to baseball, are skyrocketing in value. Some of the tiny pieces of cardboard far outpacing the stock market. And collectors, from moms to super rich DJs, are cashing in.
I pick up my phone and I'm on eBay and I'm just scrolling through.
DJ and music producer Steve Aoki says he was card obsessed as a kid. And during the pandemic, he got back into it.
I'm still heavily involved in buying and not really selling so much.
How much have you spent so far?
Oh, already over a million.
The famous DJ turned card head is so into it, he's taken a job at eBay promoting the company's trading card marketplace.
My top dollar was this card right here. It's called the Illustrator. And this is the most desirable rare Pokemon card ever. I bought this for $420,000. This thing's 100% over 1.5.
Am I a bad mom because I think I threw out my kids' Pokemon card collection?
My parents threw out all my cards. I think you're one of like a gazillion moms.
But not this mom of three.
We keep our cards in closets, under beds, and binders. You could definitely tell we are a card collecting family.
Janelle Pearsall started collecting a few years ago. When her husband had trouble finding cards at stores, she was bit by the collecting bug.
One of our most prized possession cards that we got out of a $10 pack was a Luka Doncic rookie card that we got graded and now sells for $800.
That's a 7,900% increase on her original investment, and it sparked even more collecting.
We spend about $1,200 to $2,000 a month on cards. My goodness, that's a lot of money.
The boxes of cards, she says, an investment for her children.
Holding on to some of these sealed boxes for my kids in the future will definitely be an asset for them.
Here's the Kobe.
And for collectors on a budget, alternative asset investment websites like Rally are making it easier to get in on the action. Brad Sherman signed up with a company that sells equity shares of coveted items like classic cars, rare timepieces, and trading cards.
This fractional share opportunity is a great way to invest and not take on the risk of owning the whole thing.
He and his two kids recently purchased two $25 shares of this original Pokemon card set. Current value, around $125,000.
It's very fun to do it with my dad.
And Dad's hoping the passion for Pokemon turns into a valuable lesson.
I hope to teach him that a $25 investment in a very rare Pokemon set that could be worth five times the investment.
And Shep, talk about investing. You know, Steve's Pokemon cards that we told you about earlier, he is so sure those are going to skyrocket in value. He's not storing them at home. Nope. He's got them all locked up at a top secret vault offsite, just like a Picasso or something.
Well, Chef? That's a lot of fun. Andrea Day, thank you. First, murder hornets, then brood X cicadas, the once in a 17-year pest that tortured the Northeast and the Delmarva for months. Then the cicada upgrade to ones infected with fungus-fueled STDs that turn them into these smelly, sex-crazed salt shakers of death. But they all pale in comparison to this new thing. The acid-squirting land lobsters from hell. That's what one reporter called them. Vinegaroon is the official name. That's because when prompted, they shoot a vinegar-like acid out their tails. Most recently spotted in Big Bend National Park in West Texas. Vinegaroons are nocturnal, live mostly underground, so it's rare that they make human contact. But when it rains, they come out of their burrows looking to mate and eat, we're told. Maybe a tasty cockroach for dinner. Pro tip, the Park Service says they are relatively harmless unless you annoy them. 60 seconds left on a race to the finish. Extreme, devastating weather sweeping the world. At least 25 people dead in China after the heaviest rainfall there in 1,000 years. A fourth U.S. athlete has tested positive for COVID just before the Tokyo Olympics opening ceremony. NBC News confirms U.S. men's beach volleyball player Taylor Crabb will miss the games after he tested positive when he landed in Japan. And the House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy threatening to boycott the committee to investigate the Capitol insurrection after Speaker Pelosi rejected two of his appointees. And now you know the news. Of this Wednesday, July the 21st, 2021. I'm Shepard Smith. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at The News on CNBC and listen to and follow our podcast on your favorite podcast platform. Stay tuned for Shark Tank. You've been listening to the CNBC podcast, The News with Shepard Smith. You can always catch us live weekdays at 7 p.m. Eastern, only on CNBC.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.